This is Timothy Gordon. Spring is nearly here, and accordingly, we're opening up two new sections of classes for the spring, Church History and Rules for Retrogrades. Church History is a repeat course from the fall. It was so successful that many people could not get in and want to in the spring. Rules for Retrogrades is a new course based on my book with my brother, Community Organizing from the Right. Go to timothyjgordon.com for information. Also at timothyjgordon.com, a pre-recorded Catholic Republic course on sale. Good evening, parish orphans and retrogrades. Timothy Gordon here. I'm pleased to bring you a Rules for Retrogrades episode with special guest Eric Sammons. What's up, Eric? How are you? The father of Twitter, Catholic.
Yeah, I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Tim? Good to talk to you. I haven't talked to you in a long time, so this is great.
It's been like a year.
I know. Yeah. I feel like it has been, hasn't it? That's crazy.
It's far too long. Do you have your Catholic Twitter dad jeans on just for the show? Like I asked.
Well, actually, hold on a second. See, there they are.
Okay, perfect. Okay, thank you. I mean, thank you. And the world thanks you. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Everybody wanted to know that.
I thought that it would be appropriate for us to start out this interview with you asking me if my car insurance is all in order.
And that's right, exactly.
Wiper fluid in the
that's right. The bin. I should have had some good dad jokes ready. Oh well.
I thought you always did. I thought that was your thing.
Man. I know. I'm failing you.
Well, so a lot has changed with you. I want to talk to you about a couple very, very cutting edge things. One is this crazy German synodal church, which involves a bet that you and I had, and it also involves Steve Skojic about a year ago. But before that, just tell me what's been going on with you. I was excited to be notified by my people at Sophia that you are the new editor of Crisis. It's actually not cutting edge news anymore. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yes, it's very exciting. I started at the beginning of the year, and I've written for Crisis for years, you know, just on and off. And they reached out to me and asking if I was interested. And I thought it'd be a great opportunity. I think Crisis has done good work for years. I remember when I became Catholic in the 90s, I remember reading Crisis magazine. And so it's very exciting. And I hope to take it in a good direction that really helps the church. And I mean, from the name of it, Crisis, the whole point of it is to try to address the crisis in the culture and in the church. And one of the big things for me is I don't want to just complain about the crisis. I mean, we have to call it out when things happen, but I want to give actual, okay, what do we do then? What's our response? I think that's a key thing that sometimes we miss. We get so caught up in complaining or woe is me of what's going on, but it's like, no, we have to actually do something about this. And what do we do? So I'm hoping that Crisis is part of that, along with all the other stuff going on in the church.
Excellent. Well, I noticed that topically, I know you a little bit, and I can discern that you're accepting certain kinds of articles at Crisis. I think it's a really positive direction. I always liked the online mag anyway, and I've submitted lots of pieces there and had them run there myself. But I'm going to test you. I'm just going to send a random good piece and a random bad article.
There we go.
I'm going to ask you, Eric, can you tell me which one of these is my good piece? My bad piece. Test your editorial.
Very good. Very good. I'm looking forward to that challenge. That'll be good. Yeah, I'm trying to get some new authors as well, new writers. One of the biggest things I want to take Crisis in a direction is very practical articles. I mean, the majority of our readers read it on mobile, and most of our articles are typically between 1,000 and 1,500 words. And so what that means is I want to be very practical, where somebody who's reading on their cell phone, they can read it, they can understand it, they don't have to go super deep, but it gives them practical points of, okay, here's what happened, and here's one take on it that can maybe help me understand what happened. Nothing, you know, it's not an academic journal. It's not, I love reading academic stuff, but this is not the purpose. People aren't doing that on a cell phone, on short articles on the internet. So I really want to make it a very practical pieces and have some people. I was very excited, like Janet Smith, who hasn't written for Crisis since 1990. She submitted an article last week for the first time in a long time. We ran a piece by her, and Bishop Anthony Schneider, we had him write something a week or so ago. So yeah, so it's exciting.
Yeah, no, in all seriousness, I was making a joke, but I'm very glad that you are at the helm of the ship there. On
the topical note, we have news today that the Vatican is reviewing the German synod proposals to veto bishops, elect pastors, and ordain women. And this is something that you and I and all of the Catholic commentariat were talking about roughly a year ago before the beer bug broke out.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting article. Let me read you the first paragraph, because some people haven't read this article over at The Pillar. It broke about 20 hours ago. The Vatican is reviewing a set of proposals under consideration for approval by the General Assembly of the Synodal Path of the Catholic Church in Germany, which we've all talked a lot about, this crazy synodal path. The proposals include the election of bishops and pastors by church members, elected lay committees with the power to overrule the decisions of bishops, and for a vote among German Catholics on the ordination of women to the priesthood. Now, these are all wacky ideas. What do you say, Eric? What's wrong with the church in Germany, and what's wrong with the church right now? You're the editor of Crisis.
Yeah, I think, well, it's an interesting point, because I actually think there is probably too much centralization in Rome. And so on a theoretical level, the idea of a more decentralized church on some level, I don't think is a bad idea. It's not necessary. I don't think that every single bishop in the world, for example, is picked by the Pope. That's not historically, for a long time, that's not how it's been. That's a more recent development, last 200 years or so, where every bishop is basically picked by Rome. So I start off by saying that. But then Germany, they're a bunch of wackadoodles. I mean, it just, they're crazy. But they do like kind of divide up some things, like the ordination of women in the priesthood. Obviously, that's just a no-go. I mean, I don't care if you call yourself a synod, if you're a bishop, whatever, you just simply can't change that. So even the fact that they suggest that as a possibility means they're not Catholic. I mean, they're not acting Catholic, at least. The idea that lay people could overrule the decisions of bishops, I think every one of us has within us a little bit like, hey, that wouldn't be so bad in some cases. I mean, if you're living in Chicago, you might want to have that power, or Washington, D.C. But the fact is that just goes against the divine mandate of Christ, that in which bishops have authority, and we pray for them, we hope, and we challenge them to wield it correctly and appropriately. But we don't have the authority to overrule them. I mean, whether you like it, if you don't like that, become Protestant. I mean, ultimately, that's what it means. It's just, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're just becoming, I mean, that's the birthplace of Protestantism. They're just becoming Protestant. Now, the election of bishops and pastors by church members, that one I could theoretically get behind in certain situations. It really would depend on the details. I don't think that's not against our faith. It has happened before, but how it would be done and trusting Germany to do it right, there's just no chance that that's even possible. So, but on a overall point is just that the German bishops just aren't Catholic anymore. I mean, how long have they been going on where they basically support themselves through the tax? A lot of people might not know this, but in Germany, there's a tax. If you are a baptized Catholic, part of your tax dollars go to support the Catholic Church in Germany. And you have to renounce your baptism, essentially, in order to stop that from happening. And a lot of people have actually renounced their baptism because of that. But that system makes it where the bishops there, I mean, they're supported no matter what. I mean, they just can do whatever they want. And they have this weird relationship with Pope Francis, where they seem to be completely on board with him in some cases, and then they're completely not on board with him in other cases. And it's hard to even know exactly what's going on in that relationship. I think it's like Pope Francis saying, yeah, I want to give some authority to synods, but then when they start saying this wacky stuff, he's like, well, hold on, I don't mean that.
Yeah, it's something like UTEP two-step, the old Timmy Hardaway move, I guess the Buenos Aires two-step that Francis has happening with the Germans and the Northern Europeans, because in one sense, I'm not going to pretend I don't know what the Sankt Gallen Mafia is. These are his friends, and these are the people that put him in power, in at least the most rudimentary, mechanistic way. These are the people that really wanted a Francis mm-hmm. pontificate in the first place. And we know to some extent, I'm not going to go through and catalog all the ways that they are the power players, but they do walk between the raindrops, and they have for about 8 years now. But to another another side of the coin is Francis sometimes gives the appearance of chiding them, or at least decelerating the acceleration that they seem to be garnering there, the Teutonic bishops, you know, 503 years into the Germanic Reformation of the church, really the revolt in the church. And let's give this a little bit of context. You and I and Steve Skojic had a bet, I think about 14 months ago, as to whether or not women would be, you know, formally ordained bishops. And I was like, you know, I backed it off a little, and you're teasing me. And I was like, look, they're going to be given all of the ergonomics, all the intelligible functions of deacons. And I don't know where that left the bet. And also, I failed by the timeline. I think I have COVID to blame there, but I said it would happen within 6 months. Nevertheless, I want to talk about six months. That was a hard deadline. So I think I have to wear a LeBron shirt saying something positive about LeBron James.
Yes, which I know how painful that is for you. But I'm willing to, in the spirit of graciousness and being the dad, you know, of Catholic Twitter, to absolve you of that, because, you know, COVID did slow things down. I think the bet was like by the end of last year, there'd be women deacons or something like that. Right. Essentially, it was a fun bet, because the fact is, you and I are in agreement that the direction is clearly to give women as many liturgical roles as they can get away with and push the envelope as much as possible. And I think we both know the recent decision of Pope Francis to have women lectors and acolytes. That was, you know, that's clearly a step in that direction. It's clear. I just, honestly, the whole bet from my perspective was more of timing. I just didn't think they wouldn't do anything by the end of the year. Right. And they didn't, but that doesn't mean we don't both agree that we know where they're going, where they want to go. I mean, they want women priests and women bishops. I personally, the whole women deacon thing, I vacillate. Some days I think, no, that just can't happen. I mean, if they did that, that would be something that would be against the mark of the church. It would somehow undercut the what the church is. Other days I think, well, it would be terrible, but it wouldn't necessarily undercut the foundations of the church. So today I don't know what I am, but clearly they want to make it where, to the average person looking up there, there's no difference between what the men and women do.
Yeah, there's an important hook with the beer bug, COVID-19, as it happens to be called, because not only did it decelerate whatever head of steam might have been had with the expediency of the German bishops and pushing the church to strange new places vis-a-vis women deacons or whatever. They want women priests, according to this new headline.
Right.
There seems to be an interesting interaction between the concepts here. The justification for having women ordained in any way, whether it's just ergonomically, which is a soft kind of non-ordination, or actually, according to the Germans, not only having ordained female deacons, but priests, that justification was to make up for the lack of priests who minister to those in the Amazon, not around the whole world, but the Amazon. In the post-COVID-19 world, in beer bug world, this would, one, be extended if they get their wish, now that it's 2021, not 19. And almost all the churches are operating under strict attendance caps, meaning the justification is even more erroneous than it was in the Amazon Synod in whatever that was, October of 2019, right? So no one can get into churches. Half of these churches are more of a clown show than they ever were, being held outdoors now, to add insult to sort of aggregated Novus Ordo injury. And with no one in church, they're still claiming, and with no one, virtually no one in the world being from the Amazon region, they're still claiming that they need more services by the women. Does this give the lie to what they're doing in Northern Europe in the first place, in the Episcopate?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all knew during the Amazonian Synod that was just a reason to give for making it worldwide. Nobody thought that they would say, oh, we'll have women priests or married priests or whatever in the Amazon, but then everywhere else, it's going to be just fine. And we're not going to have, we're not going to ask for that. Everybody knew that was just their entry point. That was a way they designed to introduce it. And it's just like everything that's introduced in the church. It starts off like, okay, we're going to have this little exception over here. And then all of a sudden it blows up into everything. I mean, if you go back to the Anglican church with allowing contraception in the 1930s, it was just for married people in certain very restricted situations. That was the only time contraception was allowed. And of course, within 20, 30 years, everybody's like, yeah, whenever, it doesn't even matter if you're fornicating or adultery, whatever, as long as you, contraception is all good. And so that's all, that's, it was always a joke. And just to take it back for a second on the whole synod idea is, I personally think that Francis's push of synods is just a facade. It's a way for him. I mean, there's, you know, I haven't read it, but the, of course, the book Dictator Pope, it's a way for Francis to rule the church and give it the veneer of being a community of people. We're a synod, we're all getting together. And, hey, this is just what the church wants. I'm just going with the church. When actually he's just ramrodding what he wants. Because if you look at like the Amazon synod, these other synods, what does he do? He handpicks the bishops he knows will agree with him. I mean, Cardinal Burke's not getting invited to this. Bishop Schneider's not getting invited to any of these. Bishop Strickland, something like that. No, it's the same gang gets appointed to these synods, and then they just vote for exactly what Francis beforehand tells them to vote for. But yet then they say, oh, it's the synod, so it's the church saying that's what they want. And what's happened though is Germany, I think they're taking him more literally than he intended. I mean, they're taking him at his word that he really wants this synodal church. And all of a sudden, Rome is like, hold on a second, Germany. We didn't really want you to do this. We're just, this is all supposed to be just a big show so people think it's a synod church. And that's what the Amazon synod was just a joke. It was just we have these checklist of liberal things we want to achieve. How can we achieve them? We'll act like we need to do it in the Amazon. These poor Amazonians, they need these. The only thing that will ever solve every problem in the church seems to be the exact same thing. Women priests. Women priests is the solution to literally every problem. I'm surprised it doesn't cure COVID.
I think it does.
Yeah, it's just like everything. So, you know, the whole thing is just a matter of, okay, we have ahead of time, we have this idea. We want these things, like the checklist they've had for decades. Now, how can we make it happen? And the Amazon synod was one. Now the Germans are saying, they're trying to push it even further and faster by saying, we're just going to do it here. And which, and they do, I mean, they break away from the church, which, you know, seems to be the German way. So
synodality seems to be the mechanism for what we call in the law, hollow out provision. It just means you punch a little needle-sized hole in fabric, and then you hollow it out and it's big. Exception makes bad law, but law it does make. Right. If you do it this way, and they do it the synodal pathway, and of all the false imputations by all of our friends on Catholic Twitter and in the Catholic blogosphere to Vatican II, the synodal path does date to Vatican II, and it does date to the liberal muscle who are really running that council. They know that you poke a hole, right, you hollow it out, and the exception becomes the law. Now look at COVID, for instance. I want to talk about the lack of heroism just for a brief minute, because there's a couple themes that come out of all this that I think you and I can make great hay over, because both of us are defenders of liberty, which seems to be the minority among Catholics these days, liberty lovers. And I know you're a great liberty lover. Before I get that far, Archbishop Salvatore Corleone has been one of the few, the unique bishops showing any pluck, showing any civil disobedience. But most bishops have been preaching, have not mentioned hiding their hair of their right, their sublime right from God to preach and to worship. So, what I mean, the COVID, there seems to be no hollow out provision with regard to COVID. I mean, essentially in California, they just got back into my home state, my ex-home state, they just got back into church indoors yesterday. And it's basically because the evangelicals lobbied so hard in that state. You have evangelical pastors, you know, heretics, the lovable heretics though they be, that care more about our souls than most of our bishops, Cordeleone exempted. What does this mean? What's the future of the USCCB with the beer bug? Because the beer bug seems to be here to stay.
Yeah, I honestly think COVID revealed something. It's nothing new. It just revealed something that already existed. And that is the lack of faith among our church leaders, our bishops, yes, and many of our priests. What we saw was that they were much more concerned with going along with the state, with the conventional wisdom, with what the big media and big tech and everybody was telling them they needed to say, rather than the salvation of souls. And you saw that on a macro level with the bishops, but you saw it on a micro level, because I don't know about you, but I have story after story of pastors who have been complete Nazis about masks.
Yeah.
And they've driven people out. I mean, just the other day, a friend of mine was over and she was saying she was at she was just praying after mass at this, she had to go to a different parish than her normal one. And the priest she was in mass and the priest during the homily basically told her, you have to put a mask on or you have to leave. We're not going to continue until you put a mask on or leave. And during his homily, I mean, it's just like, what on earth? How is that in any way? I mean, how's that pastoral? I mean, how is that smelling the sheep or whatever? You're smelling what comes out of the sheep. But it's like,
I think you get the smell of the sheep on you. I don't think Jesus cares whether they actually sniff the sheep.
Yeah, I don't know what they're doing with the sheep, I'll be honest. But the problem is that what it's revealed is people see, wait a second, these pastors, these priests and bishops who for decades have rolled over on everything, pro-abortion politicians, homosexual marriage, everything. They don't lift a finger. They don't ever deny communion to anybody for any type of heresy or sin, except for if you don't have a mask on, then you get denied communion like that. And what is that? I mean, that's a message they're sending, that what they think they're not following the religion of Catholicism. They're following the religion of fear and COVIDism and scientism. And so what I think we're seeing is a big shift where many Catholics who were just your typical most Sunday Catholic at your Novus Ordo parish, they're doing one of two things. They're either just leaving and just saying, it's not worth it. I mean, mass wasn't that big a deal to me anyway, so why bother? And we see that in the drop in the numbers. Or they're finding parishes where pastors care about salvation. And to be frank, those parishes, 9 times out of 10, are traditional Latin Mass parishes. That's just the reality that most cases. And I think, I was just talking to my wife about this. I think there's a reason for that. Most priests who celebrate the traditional Latin Mass, either exclusively or a lot, or they really embrace it, there's a hint of already in them that they don't go along with the narrative, the status quo of the church. They're already willing to kind of buck the system a little bit. I'm not saying disobedience. I'm not talking about disobedience. I'm just saying they don't feel like they have to go along with whatever the status quo is in the church. And so when this happened, they already had that kind of attitude of, well, salvation of souls comes before going along with whatever the latest thing from the USCCB is. So they're willing to do that. But I think that's what's happening, is because I don't know about you, but I know a number of TLM parishes that have grown by leaps and bounds since COVID. And I know a lot of dioceses, a lot of parishes are dying and just cratering members. And from what I hear, I've heard from a number of people, but these dioceses, they got no money. I think we're going to see a rash of bankruptcies over the next couple of years, because why would anybody give money to a place that's not even servicing them? I mean, they're shutting down. They're not letting you come. From a very crass way of looking at it, well, why would I give money to that? So, you know, I think that's the tragic thing that COVID has revealed, though, is that the salvation of souls is not the primary concern of too many of our pastors and bishops.
The number is not 9 out of 10. I think it's much, much more aptly 49 out of 50 or something like that. If we're trying to be realistically. Cut the bull and say faithful parishes where you're going to be admonished in the right direction. I think 9 out of 10 way undercuts it. Yeah, I think probably. You know, you're going to be diocesan or one of the faith, you know, FSSP that is faithful and tells you, look, you know, we've dealt with the cold a couple times per year, the flu once or twice per year. We've dealt with this before. We're the church. We dealt with the bubonic plague. You guys need to consider your souls and let's get back to some soteriology. That's going to be 49 out of 50 times places that are either very friendly to the Latin Mass or FSSP or ICKSP. I want to talk to you for a second as a fellow liberty lover, Eric, because we live in a world that is politically on the right and I guess politically on the right in the church, calling itself increasingly post-liberal. Let's consider the kind of confluence of the last three things we've talked about. The role of limited government in the world, you know, during COVID. The importance of limited government during COVID has expanded. Liberty is always the most important thing to be preserved, both theologically and politically, by the good regime, if you ask me. But during COVID, that's just become more evident. Let's assess that from the perspective of some of these German bishops. Look at what they want. Look at what they really want their churches to do. And I say, look, here's the superscript. There is one regime in the whole world that must needs be a monarchy. That's the Roman Catholic hierarchy, right? And it's monarchical necessarily in the diocesan structure. The bishop is usually your king. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then the Bishop of Rome is your kind of super king, right? This is the one regime in the world where you, a baptized Catholic, and me, a baptized Catholic, are necessarily under the thumb of a sovereign monarch.
Absolutely. Yep.
But listen to the way that the Germans on the left, and even a lot of our Catholic friends on the kind of fringy Catholic right, talk the second they don't like the monarch. Now, the Germans are so far on the left that even Francis isn't moving fast enough for them. And then we kind of know the story on the Catholic right. These people find themselves in the one regime that is necessarily a monarchy. Listen to what this article on the German bishop says. Committees must be democratically legitimized. They must control the executive. They're calling the bishop.
I noted that too when I read that.
It's hilarious. If it is foreseen that the bishop or the pastor can veto a decision, a qualified majority must be established by which it can be overruled if necessary. I want to point out, and I do point this out to a lot of my dissenting Catholic friends on the right who dissent a bit more than me, maybe into disobedience. I say, look, you guys aren't getting the irony here. And COVID should help to point it out that you, on the one hand, politically, you say you're a post-liberal, a monarchist, which isn't necessarily the same thing. A monarchy is one of the good regimes, but I'm for a kind of enlightened liberal monarchy, the kind that Aquinas and Bellarmine liked, if you go that direction at all. But the point is this, you want more monarchs under the sun? Here's the thing. We're not even dealing well with our little bishop monarchs or our super monarch, Francis. The second all of us start not liking the decisions, and by the way, I started whatever it was, like the day after Francis took the chair of Peter, and I've actually, I don't think I've ever lived under what I'd consider a good bishop in any of the various places in the United States. I don't like it, but except you can't dissent under a monarch. That's the point. They squelch all opposition. They don't stand up for our religious liberty to go to church. I can't remember if Chris Ferraro worked with the Orthodox Jews there in New York or in the California. It was the evangelicals. It's not the Catholics that are standing up for our liberties. So our friends on the Catholic right who say they hate liberty, who mistrust liberty, even though I guess that makes them voluntarists, which is Protestant, it's really weird because they're the first ones to dissent when we're like, look, we live under Catholic hierarchy. This is the one regime that according to our teaching must be a monarchy. The rest of the countries in the world, why live under the thumb of a monarch who has the plenary power to do sort of unenlightened despotic things like this at will? Why live under any more than one? I'm a bet hedger. What do you say?
Yeah, and I think there's also a fundamental misunderstanding by most Catholics of the virtue of obedience. And what does it mean to obey, in this case, our monarch? Because as you said, the Catholic Church is a monarchy by divine institution. It can, that cannot be changed. It cannot be turned into a democracy. Now, the monarch can decide to give more authority and powers to people under him to make decisions. He has that right because obviously he's the monarch. He can do that. But the point is that our obedience to the monarch, in this case, the Pope or our bishop, it is never absolute. The only, as St. Thomas says, the only absolute obedience we ever have is to God. We never have absolute obedience to any man, even a monarch. And so we don't always, we have a hard time as Catholics understanding. And so, like, for example, on the Catholic right, as you say, you go to the full extreme, like the Sede Vacantinus, where they just don't like the monarch, what he's doing. So they just say he's not the monarch. We don't have a monarch anymore. We don't have a pope. And it's like, well, that's convenient, but that's not Catholic. Because as a Catholic, when the monarch is not doing a good job, then you can challenge him to do a good job. You can point out how he's not doing a good job, but ultimately you can't overthrow him in this monarchy, and you can't just say he doesn't have that authority. And so it's a frustrating thing. And don't get me wrong, I'm super frustrated by it all the time. But the fact is we still have to acknowledge that the Pope has the authority given to him by God. And if he abuses that authority, that's on him and on his soul. And it's a true scandal that could lead to many souls being lost that he'll have to account for. But we can't just say, no, we can just disobey if he says, you know, if he says something that's legitimately under his powers to say, right. We have to say, okay, he's got that authority.
Which is near plenary. That's the thing. Right. Absolute power means that theoretically, it's not philosophically incoherent for that monarch or that sovereign to order us even to grave sin. That's the one thing that we can't be ordered to, kind of like wives are under the obedience of their husband. That's the one thing he cannot deign, right. Is that she do a grave sin, right? The Pope can't order us to grave sin. He can't. And it's an ecclesiastical authority because I didn't take a vow of obedience. But ecclesiastically, it doesn't matter how bad the discipline is, how tacky it is, how, you know, when it's a disciplinary matter, like getting to church, it's a little misleading to tell people because I want them to see this. Look, this is a monarchy. It needs to be. It's divinely instituted, just like you said. But monarchy is not what a lot of these people out one side of the mouth are uttering. You know, when you hear it out the other side of the mouth, it's damn near plenary. It really is. It's when we're talking about disciplines, you know, how complicit is the church going to be with regard to the state? And the bishops have pretty much all sided with it. They're like Vichy cons, Vichy Catholics. They've sided with the other side. They can say, hey, yeah, they can keep us out of church. Is that bad for souls? Probably. It's a prudential judgment call, and it's not categorically wrong, even though we all know that this is going to not turn out well, because a lot of these people aren't going to go back to church.
Well,
it is plenary power, though. It might not be absolute, but it is what we would call a plenary power. Right. And it's people should take another look at, okay, how many voluntary associations would you opt for to be under how many different kings in your life? Liberty. Right. Liberty is quite a good thing. It's quite a Catholic thing. And I'm not sure if you run into this much, but what's the only alternative? Voluntarism. We Catholics are not voluntarists. The intellect precedes the will. So liberty is a good thing. Well, what do you say?
Yeah, and I think it is. And I think one thing I see is when we talk about the authority, like, for example, the bishops, as opposed to the Pope, really, the bishops do have a certain obligation, though, to canon law. Like, they don't have the authority really to violate canon law in a true sense. The Pope does, because universal jurisdiction is universal jurisdiction. It means he can do anything he wants. He can, if there's a canon law that says you can't do something in a parish or whatever, he can do it if he wants. So obviously, if it's against the dogmas of the faith, something like that, he can't do that. But a bishop can't. And that's been one of the big debates on the bishop's authority to deny the sacraments, for example, to a non-mask wearer. Is that the canon law explicitly states when a person can receive communion and that a pastor cannot turn them down for communion if they are in a proper state and basically various things are true. And mask wearing is not is one of them. And so it, it's a tough case. I'll admit that. So if a bishop or a pastor says, I'm not going to give you communion. You can't be here in mass if you don't wear a mask. Some would argue, well, he has that authority because he is the dispenser of the sacraments. And you know, he can tell you, for example, that you can't, walk in naked, for example, and receive communion. But this is where I think we have debates about what's really allowed. Like, okay, does a pastor, for example, really have authority to tell somebody you can't receive communion without a mask? Because canon law seems to argue against it. But going back to your point of liberty, though, I just think the real fundamental problem is that the bishops and the Elias priests seem to have a taste for authoritarianism now. All of a sudden, like, they really don't like somebody. They really want people to obey them slavishly. A friend of mine just sent me a letter from a bishop. I can't remember which one it was, who basically her pastor had to read it out at mass, where it said, "I've heard that some of you at this parish aren't following my mask wearing rules and stuff like that. And if you don't start, I'm going to have to do something about it." I mean, almost it's literally worded like that. And it's like amazing because, like I said, for years, the Nancy Pelosi's of the world, you know, go up for communion, no problem. Talk about how great devout Catholics are. The Joe Biden's of the world do that. Nothing ever happens. And that's an abuse of liberty. Yet when somebody has the potential for actual use of liberty in the sense that maybe they, for whatever reason, they're not wearing a mask, it's like, no, you cannot do that. And so it's a real rejection of what I would say is true liberty, that, you know, the bishops have a certain authority. I mean, they're given the authority to serve Christ and for the salvation of souls. So when they turn down Nancy Pelosi or Joe Biden, whoever, for communion, that's for the salvation of souls. But when they turn down somebody because they didn't follow the proper two-step to get in and do everything they're supposed to do and didn't have their hazmat suit on, that's, in my mind, abuse of their authority and a violation of our liberty as Catholics.
Sure. We're on the same side in this. I don't wear, look, man, I moved to Mississippi, so I barely wear anything ever on this face. I go around and I know the non-controversial nature of 21st century, man. I know they're not going to address me, especially in a place like Mississippi. So I'm completely sympathetic to the overall point, but you're doing something that I take the opposite approach. I want to, for one thing, I just disagree. Unless the bishop's a sovereign, people need to get, because people are LARPing now. It's been a big thing, you know, emperors, kings, Holy Roman Empire. Yeah. It's been set on the shelf. It's been set on a pedestal as this wonderful thing. And what people need to understand, as Lord Acton said, is power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So it's not a surprise. It's not the exception to the rule that these bishops, who are all, you know, it's the Democrat Party at prayer,
right,
the USCCB, that they get a little taste of power and they become monomaniacal about it, like Captain Ahab. This is the rule, not the exception. But this is what power is, and I'm not arguing against it in the church. I'm just saying it's damage control. Anytime you're living under autocratic rule, as we must be in the church, you hope for good kings, and you get good kings, according to people like Montesquieu, about 1 out of 10 times. And then the rest of the time, it's pretty rough. And it's the best form of government that 1 out of 10 time, but the rest of the time, it's pretty rough. And those are pretty consistent numbers with the bishops. We'd aspire to get 1 out of 10 good bishops.
Right? Yeah, I think would love that.
1 out of 100. But the point is, it's not a categorical evil. The bishops can deny whom they want to deny. And if they say, because they're little radical left-wing autocrats, they think that the coverings are really important morally, as, you know, even Francis has talked about, they have that plenary power. That's the nature of a king, even in the church. So I think people should get a good taste of it and then be intellectually honest. Intellectual honesty is one of the most lacking virtues in the world today. This is monarchy. We can't change it in the church. We're just going to ride it out. And don't try to liberalize or mitigate what monarchy is. It is there's an absoluteness there in almost all ways. On the other hand, we ought to appreciate that we have free will. You know, we have the free will Christian iteration, rather than voluntarist Protestantism, which does not actually believe in liberty theologically. And so I just think it's funny the way that the church and the state have interacted throughout this whole beer bug pandemic. People don't seem to get the punchline. The punchline in the joke is, you want more monarchy rather than less?
Yeah,
I'm not there. And I think not enough people have gotten that joke because it's not that funny.
Yeah. And I mean, it really has been, I think that things that were somewhat hidden before have been revealed through this. And fundamentally, the bishops do not seem to care about our salvation.
Yeah.
And that's the real thing. They care much more about appeasing the state, appeasing the conventional wisdom, appeasing the media, the narrative, whatever it is. I mean, not one bishop has stood up and said, you know, maybe this whole narrative about COVID isn't exactly right. And I'm just going to say, and I'm willing to say, no, I'm going to go against it. Not one really has done that. I mean, you know, Bishop Strickland has done a good job. I mean, he's been the one who's gone up against the vaccine. And I know there's a lot of debate about that. But when it comes to the rules and stuff about the parishes, but what I don't get is they're, by doing this, they're destroying themselves, because Christ promised that the church would never fail. Did not say that the church in the United States would never fail. I mean, we saw like England, the Catholic Church was destroyed essentially in a span of just a couple decades in the 16th century. Yeah. And so there's no reason to guarantee that there'll be a Catholic Church of any size or strength in the United States in the future. In fact, I personally think, and the direction we're going, by 2030, I think the face of the Catholic Church is going to be radically different than it is today. Way, way smaller, way just a handful of parishes compared to what we have now. I mean, our bishop here in Cincinnati, he just recently announced that, like, I think we have 225 parishes, and their goal is to get that to 75. And I don't actually think they're going to have the guts to do it. They're doing a study to figure this out. But that's what he should do. There should be only probably even less than 75 parishes in this whole diocese, because the number of Catholics who actually attend and go, and they've just decimated the numbers through all the restrictions they've put on. People have just said, forget it, it's not worth it. And so it's like, I just feel like that we need to always be clear that regardless of the bishop's power, we can say very clearly what the bishops are doing with their power is they're destroying the church in America, and they're potentially therefore destroying souls, which is what is most important. I think that should be our main focus, is that their decisions are just terrible. And we see it in the numbers. I mean, we were at 20% mass attendance before COVID, which is terrible. And it dropped down to 5, and it's around 10, something like that. And so it's sad. It's terrible.
Funny old world, isn't it? And history is multivariate. So making a prediction as the pace quickens,
right,
the pace of the statists and the globalists and whoever else that's working against Providence, as it quickens, man, making a prediction for 9 years away for 2030 is really, really difficult. I mean, the funny thing is, after you get more than two variables, this is one thing I've learned. I'm almost 40. You get more than two variables in any of life's funny little circumstances, three or more variables, and it just becomes hard to make a call. I mean, look at our little bet over female deacons. It's like, that was back in October or maybe November of 2019. And lo and behold, little did we know,
the whole world would be different.
Yeah, the world fundamentally different. True globalism, whether or not, wherever you come out, in one's theorizing on beer bug, wherever you come out, the whole spectrum, it is globalism, because all the world together is like waiting to emerge back into the sunlight, bleary-eyed. And Yeah, there was like, there was who would ever have told me in November of 2019 that in 2 or 3 months time, a bet would have been thrown off by the fact that pretty much the whole world had to emerge, would have to go indoors for more or less a year, the better part of a year. It's a crazy world, and central planning doesn't work. I'm just going to throw that out there. And places like Florida are thriving, even with their allegedly laissez-faire with respect to this all. And places like California, of course, are not, as they're on the cusp of recalling their governor. And the bishops across all these places, aside from very scant, small number of exceptions, have gone along with it in a staggering way. But I still think, Eric, that the Germans will be indulged one of these times. I mean, the way I look at the relationship between Francis and the German bishops' conferences, they're his friends. He can't come out and say how close of friends they are, but at some point, now we're officially at 8 years since this pontificate has been announced, now that it's February of 2021. I think at some point there will be one more coming out party. And I'd like to ask you one more question if you have time, because yeah, sure. It involves the sort of broad scope of this pontificate. It's funny. With respect to this all, we have 8 years in. This is now the mark, kind of the point of no return, because that's the length of Benedict XVI's pontificate, right? We have two remaining dubia cardinals, which you don't hear so much about these days. We've got Walter Brandmuller, and we've got Cardinal Burke, the American. The other two have died. And these are kind of the guys that led the charge against this pontificate. They're not leading the charge against ordinary magisterium or anything like that. They're faithful princes of the church. And they led the charge against Francis in the way that the book says to do it. Cardinal Brandmuller said back in 2014, I wonder if you know this, that the playbook for the St. Gallen Mafia, and I think he meant the St. Gallen papacy, would be communion for the divorced and civilly remarried, which they got. Women diaconate, which, whatever, question mark, it's a little hazy, but still technically no. End of celibacy in the priesthood, and then intercommunion with the Lutherans, which is the German thing. He mentioned the Lutherans, and that was the plan for the universal church. What do we expect to see? Given all I said about the impossibility of making predictions along a multivariate timescale, what do you expect to see in terms of Walter Brandmuller's predictions by the end of this pontificate, whenever Providence deigns that it should come?
I think something you said early on in this discussion is the important point. One of the most important things, the way in which Francis and just basically liberal Catholicism works is they don't go out and change the official teaching of the church or something, or a doctrine or something like that. What they do is they just slip it in through practice or through lack of enforcement and things of that nature. And they do it in footnotes. They do it in catechism changes. They do it in these different ways in which basically what happens is you wake up and you realize, hey, wait a minute, we have this now. And how did that happen? And I think that's how they've done everything. And so, for example, I can see like the women deacon thing. One way they could do it is like basically Germany, the bishops start ordaining women deacons or whatever, and the Rome even complains that you're not really supposed to do that, but then they are kind of waiting to see what's the reaction going to be. And if it looks like everything's hunky-dory, then it just becomes a practice, kind of like with altar girls that happened long ago where it just effectively happened. And then eventually they said, okay, well, this is what we're doing now. And so I don't put anything past happening. I don't think, obviously, we can't have ordained women priests or bishops. That's just not possible. I personally don't think it's possible to have women ordained deacons either. But I could see them doing a false ceremony that they're saying is an ordination.
Yeah.
And then it just happens.
It was impossible. It's closed off in Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. So we're in total agreement.
I mean, I think what will happen is they'll be up there, though, acting as deacons or doing all the stuff that deacons do. And so it's like you said, it just effectively is women deacons and everything else. I mean, it's like, you know, the divorced and remarried receiving communion, It's not like they put up a big thing in canon law or something like that where they said, okay, now divorced and remarried Catholics can receive communion. But effectively, they made it clear, this is what we want. This is what we expect pastors to do. This is what the laity should expect. Same thing, I think, would happen with women deacons and with other things. And so I don't put it past any of those predictions happening. Obviously, we don't know how long Francis has on this earth, and we don't know what his successor is going to be like. But eventually, though, my guess is that you're driving out everybody except for the people who are hanging on like us, and we're just saying we're going to go to a faithful parish that believes in tradition and follows tradition, and we'll be the only ones left, because the only people left in Novus Ordo parishes would be the ones turning off the lights, because people aren't going, because what's the point of going to, I mean, it's like the Episcopal Church here in America.
Yeah.
It goes to that. I mean, they're dying, and the same thing will happen effectively for the Catholics. And then hopefully then long-term you have the turnaround, because then the only Catholics left will be the ones who believe in tradition. So they'll start. And we already see that. We see that it's where the traditional parishes are growing right now. And so hopefully that's where we get our priests and our future bishops and popes, but that's the long game. That's after I'm gone, before any of that stuff probably happens in effect. So I do think it's going to actually get darker before it gets brighter.
Amen and a women, as they say. And I'm not saying that to it be it all happening after you're long gone. I hope it happens while you're still long here. But
can you imagine Catholic Twitter without Catholic Dad?
Oh yeah, it would be. I think it was Bulgakov that said, an Eastern Orthodox that said, after Vatican I, he admitted, or maybe it was a Soloviev that said, the 14 autocephalous Eastern Orthodox churches without Papa to call the sons to the table, how do they ever dine together? That's what Catholic Twitter would be without you, Eric Sammons.
Well, I fully expect to eventually get kicked off of Twitter just because they're getting crazy. I mean, I got banned for a day just because of, I said, like, transgenderism is a mental illness and some other things like that. And so I would not be shocked if within a year I'm off Twitter because they kicked me off. I'm going to stay until they kick me off.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Yeah. I was interviewed in a debate panel format on a big news service on the internet. And I was going to upload on the topic you mentioned in the military. And I only had like probably 105 speaking seconds. So I was going to release them on Twitter. I did it and I was like, nope, I'm taking that back. Cause even for saying I was dressed up nicer than I usually dress, and it looked really sharp, and it was like a format. It looked like Fox News, very widely watched in certain parts of Europe and Canada. And it's like, now I can't do that. Cause we're all going to be kicked off eventually. Eventually, a long enough tablet of history, we're all dead men. And that's all the more true for social media. So who knows what's out there? One thing I will say, while I'm still on YouTube and going strong, one thing, thank you very much, Eric Sammons, for joining me today, but I will be opening up some new courses on timothyjgordon.com, because on Thursday nights in another couple months, my current courses will come to an end. So the two new courses will be a spring session of church history, where you can learn that all this stuff really has happened before, and a rules for retrogrades course, which I've never before given. So go and click enroll on timothyjgordon.com. That'll be Thursday nights starting in April. We're opening enrollment now. It's already open. So I really appreciate all the parish orphans and retrogrades congregating here to meet Mr. Eric Sammons. I appreciate you, and I'm genuinely happy that you're at the helm of the ship on Crisis. Eric, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And everybody enroll in Tim's classes. I'm sure they're going to be great.
Thanks, man. Have a great night, and maybe I'll submit something to Crisis now that you're editor.
Yeah, and make sure it's not the bad one, though.
All right, God bless you, man. God bless all you people out there. Remember to subscribe, click like, who knows what's going on with their algorithms, and hit the bell, or else subscribing and hitting like does no good. God bless you, Dave.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee.
Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee.
Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women.